welcome to a very special episode of the Not The Top 20 podcast. For once, it's not Ali Maxwell alongside me, but it's someone with a wealth of EFL experience as a player for West Brom and for Preston mainly, and as a manager for Portsmouth, Blackpool, Blackburn, and then crucially at Oxford, where he oversaw one of the most successful spells in the club's career. And he is the definitive answer to the age-old question of which manager would you least like to fight, basically. and it's Michael Appleton. Thank you so much for being here, Michael. It's an absolute pleasure for me to sit here alongside you as an Oxford fan.
No, listen, it's great to be here, although I'm not sure I'll be in the UFC ring at the minute. I seem to have lost about 2 stone in wake of an injury, but... yeah, I'm sure once I get my arm sorted out, I'll be back.
Yeah, as I said, you said when you walked in that you're feeling a bit light at the moment. I wouldn't like to take you on now. So anyone who's watching this instead of listening, you'll see that Michael's still fairly large, in a good sense, I must say. But let's get straight into it. And obviously, you left Oxford coming up to 18 months ago. You went into a job at Leicester assisting Craig Shakespeare. And you left that role in the summer. So, I mean, what have you been doing since leaving that role? You've been keeping a close eye on the EFL since you left Oxford, and again since you left Leicester.
Yeah, I've been trying to get to as many games as I possibly can at different levels, to be fair, because, you know, ultimately I do have an aim, if possible, to go back into the Championship and manage. I've had experience of doing that before going to Oxford, and obviously then coming back as a number two at Leicester. But I think it's important to know players within different leagues as well. So, you know, this weekend, I've not decided which one yet, but I will go to one of the League One games and have a little look, because there's a lot of players out there in the lower levels that get missed, and there's a lot of diamonds. And I think you look back to the side that we had at Oxford just before I left, that were playing in League One, a lot of them previous to me leaving. And then obviously since I've left, I've gone on to play in the Championship and some in the Premier League anyway.
It's interesting you mentioned that. I was going to bring this up later, but I did a little bit of research, and we'll talk about your time at Oxford later on. But just in case you weren't aware, of the players you brought in at Oxford, 6 of the permanent signings are now playing in the Championship. 3 of the loanees now playing regularly in the Championship, 1 in the Premier League in Jonjo Kenny. And 3 of the players you brought in at Oxford are the 3 key players now in Curtis Nelson, Simon Eastwood and Rob Hall. So you obviously did something well in terms of recruitment. So I guess now in the position you're in, it's making sure that you still have your finger on the pulse now as just as much as you did then.
Yeah, definitely, absolutely. And you know, you need to know who are the young players that are coming through, who are the young players that need an opportunity that they might not be getting at one of the bigger clubs. I think most managers out there realise that sometimes when they take a player on loan and it's his first loan, it is a little bit of a risk. It's a risk to the player, it's a risk to both the club, the parent club, and the club he's going to. What we try to do as much as we possibly can when we were at Oxford is take a player possibly on his second or third loan, depending on his age, because obviously he already experienced what it's like to be at a club, the pressures that go with playing three times a week. My days at Oxford, certainly the last 2 seasons, I'm near enough with a figure, but I'm not 100%. I think it was 60 and 61 in terms of the amount of games we played. In my second and third season, so we knew that the squad that we'd had would have to be at a cope with playing a lot of games, because we took the cup competitions really seriously. I'm a big believer in winning games and trying to win every game that you're playing, no matter what it is. And you could argue that it possibly cost us in my final year at League One because of the amount of games that we had, but I would never change that philosophy ever. You know, I think it's important to try and compete in whatever competition you're in. So when you go back to take young players in on loan, I think sometimes they get exposed too early, and then if it's their second or third loan, that's the one where you can really jump on, and you know you've got a player who certainly is coming to a point and an age in his career that you can kick on.
It's interesting you say that, because the one that sticks out where maybe in your time there it was the opposite, and it was the first loan was Tyler Roberts, who's obviously now got Leeds and couldn't really show what he could do when he was at Oxford.
Yeah, exactly. And to be fair, we did our best to try and keep Tyler in the building. We knew that Walsall would get it was Walsall. We knew Walsall would get a little bit more out of him than what we did. Just because that was his second loan. As it happened, obviously, him going to Shrewsbury was what really reignited and kicked his sort of career on. But it's interesting that, obviously, One of the recruitment guys who I had at Oxford at the time, Craig Dean, who's now at Leeds United.
Roof and Tyler Roberts.
Exactly. Yeah. So as you can imagine, the ties there, and you know, that's probably one of the reasons that you know, Leeds ended up taking the, well, I wouldn't say it was a gamble, certainly not on Roof, but for them to pay the money that they had paid for Tyler. I think over a period of time he will show his worth, and he just started to do it. Ironically, with Roofy out of the team because of his injury, he's getting his opportunity now.
Absolutely. So we're going to look back at your career a bit more later on in the podcast, but now let's look at the Championship as it is now. And you say you're keeping your finger on the pulse. We've seen you do a fair bit of media work. I mean, who's taking your eye? And firstly, we'll talk about the team towards the top end of the table in West Brom.
Yeah.
Darren Moore, obviously a good friend of yours, someone you've worked with before at Blackburn, as well as a teammate. And then Harvey Barnes, who you must know from your time at Leicester, who's on loan there doing incredible things.
He certainly is, and he's definitely one of the outstanding players in the Championship at the moment. I think it's hard to disagree with that. I mean, some of the goals he's scored have been quite incredible, to be fair. And key goals and crucial goals in terms of the timing of them. None more so than, you know, the other week, scoring two late goals at Sheffield Wednesday, which were massive to keep that momentum going for West Brom. So he's been outstanding. He's got great ability. He's certainly a player who gives you options on either side of the field, but I believe that his strongest position is as a number 10 and feeding off a striker, because he scores goals, as we've seen, but he does create goals for people as well. And he's such a strong runner with the ball. He was a player that was on the periphery last year at Leicester, had a couple of cup games, was in around the squad towards the end of the season. And to be fair to the lad, I think the first half of last season when he was out on loan at Barnsley, he had a mixed time, but obviously when he played well, he certainly played well, and that's something that we were aware of. And he's doing great there now. You know, you've got to look. We were talking about before we went on air, so to speak. But you know, Mason Mount's doing incredibly well at Derby County. You've got to look at sides like Wigan Athletic, and as an example, Nick Powell doing wonders. I mean, he's picked up an injury and he's missed the last couple of games, I believe. But you know, I've seen him play a couple of times early on in the season. He was outstanding. You know, and there's players within there that I think will flourish as the season goes on. I mean, obviously, Jack Grealish, the fact that he's still in the Championship, I think it's a big plus for the Championship. I think it's a little bit of a negative that he's not in the Premier League, and Aston Villa fans won't forgive me for saying that.
I'm a signed up member to the fan club, so I agree.
You know, I believe potentially he's got absolutely everything and he can be anything he wants to be. I really do. I think the kid's superb. You know, so there is a lot of talent there. There's bags of talent there. You know, Kamar Roof is another one. You know, he started the season like a house on fire. Unfortunately, he's picked up an injury, someone I know very, very well.
With Roof, was it, I mean, as a fan, it was frustrating to me to see him go to Leeds and be played out of position straight away, and to see people not really understanding the player that he was. When you've helped develop a talent like you did with him, do you share that as well, or are you always on the phone to him, kind of hope he can improve?
Yeah, I mean, obviously we still stay in touch. Interestingly, we come up against each other last season, although it wasn't something that, you know, that I wanted at the start of the season. But when Craig was sacked by Leicester, I ended up taking the reins for a couple of games, and the Leeds United game in the Carabao Cup was one of them. And to be fair, he was playing on the right hand side that night, and I can't remember if it was the first half or second half, and he was near the touchline, and I was giving him a little bit of stick and telling him he's not working hard enough, and you know, and you know, he did remind me that I wasn't his manager. But now, listen, it was one of them where we had such a good you've got to remember, I've probably known Roofy since he was 14.
Yeah.
So I worked with him as a youth coach and him as a youth player at West Brom. And then, as you always do with your players that are doing well, you keep tabs on them and you see how they progress and how they develop. And I think he was probably frustrated at first, but initially I think when you go to a new club at a different level, sometimes if you have that ability to play either side or centrally, just from a pressure point of view on a manager, sometimes there's a lot of pressure on managers to stick with players, and if they've not had a particularly good game, it's almost easy to put them on either side rather than keep them in them central areas.
You can hide them a bit there, can't you?
Yeah, a little bit. So it's getting that balance right. Fortunately for Rufie, he's had a fantastic pre-season. They've brought in a manager that's got super experience and clearly believes in him, you know, to play him. Everyone keeps talking about him playing rather than Bamford. So good for him, you know. I'm delighted for him. Hope he gets back fit and playing soon.
Yeah, fingers crossed. And it's interesting looking at the managers in the Championship at the moment. A lot of guys that you'd have faced in League One and League Two in the last couple of years, you're looking at Paul Hurst, Paul Cook, these guys who maybe getting the opportunities they wouldn't necessarily had a couple of years ago. Dean Smith as well, another one. Do you think that in the last kind of 10 or so years, the tide's turned a bit where now these bigger clubs in the Championship are willing to take a punt on managers who've done good things in the basement two divisions?
I certainly hope so. I'm not convinced, I'll be honest with you, I'm not convinced. I certainly hope so. It does concern me a little bit, the amount of foreign coaches that are coming in into the second, third and fourth level in terms of Championship, League One and League Two. I get it, Premier League level, I understand that, the money involved, the type of players that are involved. I'm not, like I say, I'm not a big fan of, you know, seeing too many in the Championship, the League One and League Two. Maybe biased as a British coach, but ultimately at the end of the day, you know, that's the reason why when we finish playing for whenever that is, you know, we take our badges, we do our time in the trenches, so to speak, being a youth team coach, reserve team coach, and then when we had the opportunity or we want to get that opportunity, if I miss out on an opportunity to a fellow British coach, then, you know, fair play, good luck to him. But sometimes it can be a little bit difficult to take, you know, if you miss out on an opportunity to a foreign coach. And that's me just being honest. And I think a lot of British coaches in the country will probably agree with me and back me up on that one. But I am glad the likes of the names you said, obviously Dean Smith has done fantastically well. And it won't be long before either he takes Brentford into, you know, the Premier League, or someone, you know, has a punt on him.
Could be Villa looking at it at the moment.
Yeah, it could, you know, and if that's the case, then great for him. And, you know, the likes of Cookie and Hursty, it's one of them where they've sort of, they've had to bide the time, wait for their opportunity. You know, they've, with the Cookie one, it's an interesting one because, obviously, he's done ever so well at Pompey, did ever so well at Chesterfield, and obviously last year getting the opportunity with a good, very, very strong Wigan squad, a very strong Wigan squad. He did what was the remit at the start of the season to get promoted. And I think with Paul, I think he had a fantastic couple of years at Grimsby. People were aware of him. We actually played them in the FA Cup in my second year at Oxford. So 3-1. I knew, I might have been 3-0, 3-1. I think James Roberts got a couple of goals at the time.
Yeah.
And so I was aware of Paul from that, because every time they played in and around the Oxfordshire area, they used our training facilities, or if they were going up north and we were halfway or wherever it may be. So I was aware of Paul, and then when he got the Shrewsbury job, obviously he did well to keep them in the league initially, and I don't think anyone could have seen what they did with Shrewsbury last year. I know it fell away towards the end of the season, which can happen, but for them to be even challenging and competing, it was a great season for them.
I think in any normal League One campaign they'd have been promoted, just two of the class acts we've seen at that level season.
Absolutely, yeah.
Interesting that neither of us have mentioned Chris Wilder here, but I think maybe that shows a lot about our history.
I mean, to be fair to Chris, you know, he's difficult to argue, you know, arguably Chris over the last probably 3 years, 4 years, has done better than any of the other, you know, English coaches, and you know, he did ever so well at Northampton, and then got the opportunity to, similar to the Wigan one, where you go into a League One club where you've got all the resources, you've got the financial backing, and you've got the squad. You add to the squad with quality like he did do, and you get the results. And you know, and you know, for them to. The probably the more impressive side of it is how well they've done in the Championship, and they've continued to do it. And you know, I personally, you know, they do well, and they finish in the top six this year, because a lot of the players that, you know, he is working with, I've worked with before.
Yeah.
You know, so and it was interesting to see Marvin Johnson go in there on the last day of the season.
Johnson, Baldock, Lundstrom, Jake Wright.
And there's a couple of other players as well that we tried to sign at Oxford during, I think, my second year, and basically just couldn't afford them, and we got outpriced by Sheffield United at the time.
Yeah, I wonder if there's more to that than meets the eye. But and finally, before, but we're going to talk about Portsmouth first. But before we do that, just your old mate Darren Moore. Has it been not a surprise to you to see how well he's done? I mean, but has he always been a talented coach? He seems like an unbelievably good man, as you can see by his interviews.
Yeah, I mean, he is the proverbial gentle giant, really. Do you know what I mean? He's a massive giant of a man. Hence the nickname Big Dave from those who remember the is it the pot noodle advert? Back in the day. He's a good man first and foremost. In terms of coaching and coaching ability, you know, he has done his time as a youth team coach now for a number of years, and he obviously got the opportunity to work with the first team when Tony Pulis was in charge. So he's had that education. He's aware of the responsibilities that go with being a manager and working at the senior level. And I think what he did last year in the five or six games that he had, you know, was great, and it was thoroughly deserved. And for them to challenge and make it last as long as it did, and kept that little bit of a hope that all the Baggies fans had, was great. And I think what he has done as a manager, football's all about timing anyway. I suppose life's about timing. Football is all about timing, and getting that opportunity with a group of players at that right time can be crucial, and it can make or break you. And he's got a fantastic squad, and he knows that. There's a lot of pressure on him. He also knows that. But he's big enough and strong enough to be able to deal with that pressure. And listen, touch wood, and I hope I'll be amazed if they don't finish in that top two this year. With the front two they've got of like Dwight Gayle and Rodriguez, I'd be absolutely amazed. But ultimately, you've still got to go and do it. You've got to go and deliver every week. And I'm sure he will. And like I say, you know, I wish him all the best with it.
Fingers crossed to West Brom, obviously a club close to your heart. It's where you started your coaching career after your playing career ended prematurely as an academy coach, then assistant to Roy Hodgson, and then a caretaker briefly when Roberto Di Matteo left. And then Portsmouth took a decent punt on you, giving a long-term contract initially. And things obviously didn't go to plan there with the financial troubles. Do you look back on that as being a bit of a... I mean, it's obviously a huge club, and it's great to see them doing well again now. Do you see that as being a bit of a nightmare first job because of what went on behind the scenes, or did you learn a lot from that process moving forward?
No, I've got to say, the 12 months I had at Portsmouth it was probably the best 12 months or best education I'll ever have in football management ever, you know. And I remember speaking to Sir Alex at the time.
It's a good name drop, that.
Yeah, coming towards the end of my time at Portsmouth. And to be fair, he did say to me at the time, he said, you've probably had more experience in 12 months or just under 12 months than some of the senior managers might have in 20 years of the game. You know, the things that you've gone through, and obviously it was a double administration. I met some fantastic people down there. The staff were brilliant with me. We had trouble after trouble every single day. There was always something going on. The fans were brilliant with me. And, you know, we got ourselves in a position where we had to reduce the budget by something like 70% in 1 month, or the club was going to fold. You know, so you know, we were paying initially, you know, players' wages being quite high championship level, to bringing in players who were, you know, playing for teams in the 23s and under 18s, and we were having to replace, like I say, household names and players.
FA Cup winners, some of them.
Exactly, yeah. You know, 2 years previous to that, they were winning the FA Cup, and it was difficult, but enjoyable at the same time. And you know, if we wouldn't have had the 10 points taken off us, we would have been fine. We wouldn't have gone down. That was a big achievement for all the players and the staff who were there at the time. And I learned a lot. I did learn a lot. It become too much in terms of. I stopped enjoying it towards the end because it wasn't, for me, that wasn't being a football manager. I felt as if I was part of the administration team because I felt I was doing their job as well as doing my job. You know, and I found myself pretty much the last 6 weeks of being in the job, going from the training ground, which ironically was in Southampton at the time, going from the training ground to Fratton Park, and either having a meeting with the administrators about potential new owners or speaking to potential new owners. And that was my life for 6 weeks. It was just like training. And, you know, you want to be thinking about the next game. You want to be thinking about players you can sign, players that you might need to move on, etc., and be a proper football manager. But I just felt like I was an administrator for 6 weeks, and I just thought, this surely, you know, it must be something different. Football management can't be this. So I knew pretty much when the time was coming, what arguably I could have done was be a little bit more selective in my next move.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, it didn't get much easier after that. Initially at Blackpool, then pretty quickly after onto Blackburn, the Oystons and the Venkies, not necessarily two owners who I think managers would choose to work for now. Though obviously good times are returning to Ewood now. But do you look back on taking those jobs with any regret after what happened at Portsmouth?
I think it's hard not to. I do. And just through no fault of my own, if I'm being honest with you. But it's hard not to feel a little bit of regret, because they were jobs that basically no one was going to succeed at, you know. I find myself, it was quite weird really, because I find myself where I go from Portsmouth to Blackpool almost being headhunted, you know. So, you know, Blackpool have to pay compensation for me to take me away from Portsmouth. Then I found myself being headhunted again very, very quickly from Blackburn, sorry, to Blackburn from Blackpool, where they had to pay compensation. So all along the way, all these clubs are making money off me, but I'm sort of moving forward, or think I'm moving forward. And I found myself in a position when I left Blackburn, it's the first time I've ever been sacked. You know, I've been at, you know, West Brom, Pompey, Blackpool, and found myself at Blackburn, and it's the first time I ever lost my job. Like, and the way it happened was quite hard to take at the time. I was sat by someone I'd never met, and it was literally an envelope over the desk. So that was quite difficult to sort of deal with and cope with how it was done at the time. But then, you know, I look at it with a little bit of pride, because the clubs that are left, Portsmouth, Blackpool and Blackburn, for a while, at least 2 or 3 years after I left, you know, from where I had them and feel as if I had them clubs in a stable place, they actually went downhill, you know, and Pompey ended up, you know, going down into League Two when they were mid-table, League One when I left. Blackpool, mid-table Championship, pushing up, find themselves in League Two and having to work themselves back up. And obviously a year or so after I left Blackburn, them getting relegated into League One as well. So I'll try and defend my time and my record at certainly Blackburn and Blackpool, but ultimately I didn't get enough time to, I suppose, stamp my personality and authority on both clubs.
It's interesting with Blackpool, because you're not the first manager that has been treated a bit like a saleable commodity. It seems like they're investing in the hope they can get compensation and recoup it. When the offer came in from Blackburn, were you effectively forced out the door? Were you told that you were leaving, or was it a case?
No, not at all. Like I say, I can't, you know, say that at all. No, it was one of them where, I suppose, whether it was naive or not, my thought process at the time was, obviously Henning Berg had been in the job as the previous full-time manager, and Gary Bowie was caretaker at the time, but Henning Berg had lasted 50 odd days or whatever it may be, and in my mindset was, right, well, they've just done that, so they can't do that again. You know, they must be, you know, they must think that they're going to, I thought they were going to give me a little bit of time, because the remit was just pretty much stay in the league and rebuild and try and reduce the wage bill as best we possibly can. And I certainly tried to do that. You know, I think we reduced the wage bill in the January alone by about £4 million. You know, and that was just the start of what I felt was going to be a difficult but enjoyable 2 or 3 years, and it never happened. And the good thing, certainly from a Blackburn point of view, they've got a very capable manager now, and someone I know quite well from my time at West Brom, who is a good manager, plays good football, you know, and certainly from a stability point of view, that club looks a lot more stable now than obviously, you know, when I was there.
Definitely. And one fantastic result, and you were there, was of course the cup win against Arsenal. Mm. Not the only good cup scalp you've had in your career, as well as a manager at Oxford, obviously beating Swansea in the FA Cup, beating Newcastle, beating Brentford 4-0, getting to the two finals of the Chequered Trade as well. And I was at Middlesbrough that day when we went 2-2 and then lost 3-2. It's still probably my favourite ever away game as a fan, even though we had that sucker punch at the end with 5 minutes of absolute madness.
Yeah.
Why, why are you so good at managing in cup competitions? What is it about the mentality you instill in the players or the tactics that seems to be able to beat teams who should be better than you?
Yeah, what I would say, and I'm not trying to sort of down my achievements from that point, it's easier to be the underdog, first and foremost.
Really?
Is it? Yeah, I do, because the pressure's not there as the underdog. I'll give you an example. Obviously, the semi-final against Luton for the Chequered Trade, the second year, that was a very different semi-final to the year previous against Millwall, because we were the underdog. We were a League Two side going up against a League One side. It was a strong League One side. And for us to come through that, there was a little bit less pressure on us. Probably a little bit more pressure in the second leg, because we were 2-0 up from the first leg. So, and we got through it. But with Luton being a League Two side the following season, and us a League One side, I know myself and the players felt a little bit more pressure. Don't get me wrong, I knew we had a good side and we were capable of winning the game comfortably if we had to. But that was difficult. So that when you go up against a lot of the Championship clubs that we did do as a League Two side and League One, and obviously Swansea's a Premier League side and Middlesbrough, the expectation was for the Premier League side to win. It was just how could we adapt and what could we bring to the table? You know, are we going to make a game of it, or is it just going to be steamroll? And I think in certainly most of the games, it was interesting, because in the first half, or certainly early part of the game, it's incredible how the underdogs, the sides that are coming from the lower leagues, they lack that little bit of belief.
Mm.
You know, it's almost we're okay. We can actually play with these guys. It's all right. We can give them a game. And I see that, you know, year in, year out in the cup competitions. And I think the thing that we try to do over a period of time is, look, this is an opportunity that, you know, you're not going to get back tomorrow.
Yeah.
You're not going to. It's not a league game where you lose 3 points but you've got an opportunity to put it right on Tuesday. This is a cup game. It's a different. And our mentality was very, very different for cup games than it was for the league games, because the league game, it's almost like the Bill Walsh scenario. You know, the game takes care of itself, or the score takes care of itself, because we prepared the same way most weeks, day in, day out, knowing that what our end game was, and that was promotion, and that's what we wanted. Whereas the cup games, it was, listen, there was no like holding back, there was no sort of, you know, different mindset that's challenging from a league point of view, knowing that you're up against a certain type of player. This was right, okay, we're going to go out and attack, and if we lose the game, we lose the game, but we lose the game, and they know they've been in a game. And yes, from that point of view, it was just like, show them respect, but then don't show them too much respect, because if we show them too much respect, we're going to get a bit of a hiding.
In the Swansea game, I think Oxford dominated possession in that game, really.
Even, you know, it's one of them. I think some of the bigger games that we played, even like the Brentfords and the Birminghams and even Rotherhams, etc., that we the one, I think you'd find that we were definitely up there. I'd like to think that my philosophy is a very much possession-based type of philosophy, but I'm not obsessed with possession.
Yeah.
You know, what I am obsessed with is chances and good chances that are created, and working the ball into areas of the pitch that we train to do every single day in training. There's areas of the pitch where I want my best players on the ball every day, and we do that every day in training. How can I get my best players on the ball 25, 30 yards from goal, or in the box, or in certain areas? And that will be the difference between success and failure, not keeping the ball for 70% possession, and, you know, because 30, 40% of that might be in your own half of the pitch.
But it's interesting you're talking about the stats now And Ali and I on the podcast speak a lot about the kind of the data behind the performances, and maybe not looking too much at the league table at this stage, but looking more at the underlying numbers, looking at XG data as well. Is that something, I mean, it's obviously something that's come into football, at least from a fan's point of view, in the last 5 or 6 years. As a manager who as a player didn't really grow up with it, is it, are you looking to adapt, or are you looking to use it, you know, not use it too much, make sure you trust your own instinct more, or are you buying into this new age of data and stuff?
I certainly do buy into it. I think it's one of them where I'm just very careful how much I use. I think with stats and data, I think they are very important, because what they do is that they back your instincts and they back your eye, and you know, just simple things like the GPS that everybody uses at the minute, you know. The stats don't lie. If I sit down with a player and get him on a one-to-one situation and I tell him, you're not working hard enough, you're not sprinting hard enough, and he says, oh, I disagree. Well, you can't disagree with it. You know, it's in black and white. They're the hard facts. So I always have them with me if I need them. You know, but in terms of technical performance, you know, I try to hold them back, certainly, if I can do, and just speak to the player on a one-to-one and go, look, you know, we need to get you in these areas more. You need to improve at doing this, whether it's playing with your back to goal, whether it's, you know, playing between the lines, whatever it may be. I try and speak to them on a level rather than using the stats that we have. But if they're not having it, or they don't agree, or, you know, I think they're disagreeing in the wrong areas, then I'll use them to obviously back what I'm saying up.
Because we're seeing at the moment, Darren McAntony, who owns Peterborough, is getting very angry on Twitter with people like us saying that actually whilst they're coming second in the league, they're, in terms of shot data, should be about 17th, 18th. If it was your team, and luckily for you, I think Oxford always very high in the kind of the XG's tables whenever you were in charge, but if it was your team and you were second and that was maybe suggesting something wasn't quite right, would you be doing the same as someone like that, where you'd be thinking that now we're fine, we're picking up the points? Or would you look at that being like, okay, maybe there is an issue here?
I was quite lucky, actually, I suppose, with having someone like Daryl as a chairman. You know, don't get me wrong, we didn't always see eye to eye, and we had our words and stuff like that, but we were very straight with each other, and you know, whether one of us disagreed or didn't like what the other one was saying, we'd still say it, and that was quite interesting, because of the background that he come from, you know, private equity. Yeah. Obviously, that was a lot to do with figures and stats, and, you know, so I couldn't get away with, you know, the phrase, you know what can baffle brains. I couldn't do that with Daryl, because I couldn't come out with a load of waffle and pretend, you know, we're okay, we're doing well, we're doing this, we're doing that. Because he was aware of it, and he was aware of all the stats that you're talking about. So, you know, there'd be times when he'd come to me and say we'd had 5 games and we only had 1 win and a couple of draws, a couple of defeats. He'll go, look, don't worry about it. Yeah, actually, you know, you should have won four or five of these games. Like, you know, and so he used to use that with me quite often.
You're just paying Dan Bond, the performance analyst, to slip him.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, Bondy was very good at that, to be fair. Yeah. But no, it was one of them where I'd like to think that I'm realistic to know that if we won 2 or 3 games or had a period of games where we've overachieved in terms of chances created and, you know, maybe the chances that opposition have created against us, I think it's one of them where you accept it, because, you know, ultimately, you can't be brilliant all the way through the season. You're going to have to be a team of all for all seasons. You're going to have to win games that, you know, particularly you've not played really well in. But as long as you're aware of them and you're continually trying to improve and get better, and if we've got poor stats after 15 games, yet we're top of the league, what I'll do is I'll just make sure that I don't leave anything to chance, because if you're happy with that and you continue to do the same things that you have done, the reality is you're probably, by the time the next 15 games are up, you're probably going to be mid-table or below. So I understand where you're coming from. I can understand, you know,
where the real football men are coming from.
Yeah, exactly. So it's just having that balance. And, you know, I was quite lucky, like I say, I had a chairman who was open to discuss, and he was open-minded enough to understand that, you know, if we'd had a poor spell, actually he'd look a little bit deeper and see the reasons why we were.
let's get on to Oxford now. And again, as a fan, when it came out of the blue at your appointment, it was part of a takeover. You were announced as part of the takeover. And after the spells at the clubs that we'd just previously spoken about, I'm not going to lie, I was fairly underwhelmed because I didn't really know about the background story of it. And what ensued was, as a fan, probably the best 3 years that Oxford have had in terms of cup runs, in terms of the promotion, in terms of the performances, the players as well. I mean, you must look back on that 3 years with immense pride, I hope.
Oh, massively. I mean, you know, I think it's going to be, you know, wherever I go in the past, in terms of actually a period and a spell at a club, it'll be very, very difficult to top that in terms of being relative. So, you know, whether I go and work in the Championship, the Premier League, League One again, or League Two, in terms of relative, what you can achieve as a League Two club or a League One club, in terms of promotions, in terms of cup upsets and getting to Wembley finals and producing players, it's going to be hard to top. So I'm realistic to know that, you know, them 3 years were memorable and certainly very enjoyable, not only for me, for my kids, for my wife. I mean, to be fair, like I say, at the time when we moved down there, there were myself and my wife, now Jess, who was my girlfriend, fiance, etc. Then it was a little bit, right, okay, this has to work. Yeah. And I remember saying to her, this has to work. My reputation's on the line.
And it was a hairy start as well.
Yeah, it certainly was. You know, and if anything, you know, we lost the first four games. Arguably, them first four games, they were as good as performances that, like, as we probably had when we were like getting promoted and, you know, and obviously playing well against top sides, but ultimately it just didn't happen. And for whatever reason, it took a little bit of time to have an understanding of the team that was there at the minute. I think there was certainly a few players that, through no fault of their own, almost had a losing mentality. It's not that they wanted to lose, it was just that it became almost acceptable, might be the wrong word, but it came a situation where it was like, it's not that bad if we lose, you know, and it's, you know, don't worry too much about it. Whereas, like, no, I wanted to change that mentality, and that actually, it, you know, if we lose a game of football, anyone can lose a game of football, but I want to make sure that we've done everything in our power possible to make sure that we can win the game. There was a lot of things that went on in that period of time, and I think that some of the biggest things that happened, it's a little bit of a buzzword in football at the minute, and a lot of people talk about it but don't implement it. We actually changed the culture of the football club, there's no doubt about it. Certainly in the second season, more than ever, we tried really hard in the second half of the first season to, like, say, change people's mentalities. And then there was no stone unturned in terms of the way we prepared for that season that we got promoted. I had to make some really, really difficult decisions on players, on staff, members of staff, which wasn't particularly easy or I didn't enjoy, but it had to be done for the benefit of everyone. And I think it was round about that time and just before the end of the previous season where the relationship between the fans and the players and the football club sort of come together. And it put aside a lot of the stuff that I'm hearing about and seeing at the minute, obviously with previous owners. And we all focused on the football. And I think that's why we were so successful.
You mentioned that obviously things not looking so good for the club at the moment, in 24th position, a takeover in the summer. Carl Robinson came in and did very well at the back end of last season to almost keep Oxford up, which would have been unthinkable when you left. Yeah. But it hasn't been as good this season. And Carl Robinson said a lot in the press that he finds the Kassam Stadium a very hard place to play. The players don't like playing there. It doesn't feel like they're playing at home. Can you sympathise with that? Or do you think that's maybe an excuse for poor performances? Not to kind of direct you to push him under the bus.
I think it's probably a little bit of both. Ultimately, at the end of the day, you know, you need to look after yourself and you're going to try and defend yourself and your team as much as you possibly can. I think what Carl's saying is it can be difficult, obviously, with that fourth stand missing.
Yeah.
From a conditions point of view, so when the weather's not particularly great and it's windy.
He's saying it in the summer.
I mean,
to look forward to.
Yeah, exactly. So that can be difficult. From an atmosphere point of view, there's no doubt about it that if you've got four stands, you know, you can create an atmosphere that's is more beneficial to you as a home side. But what I would say is that, you know, that's something that we worked again really hard with when I was at the club, just to improve the relationship with the fans and get a little bit more of an understanding and of what we were trying to do and why we were trying to do it. And I think the amount of people that were turning up every single week because they sort of believed in what we were doing was a big factor, you know. So to average, I think before I left, it was around about 8,500, you know, most weeks, which was fantastic. And it was hard to argue with the atmosphere that was being created in them games. You know, the atmosphere was incredible towards the end when I was leaving. So I understand. It's certainly, there's no doubt about it, there's no getting away with it. It's certainly a lot more difficult than most places just because of the fact that it's only got three stands.
And I think there are issues now between the new owners and the previous owner who owns the stadium that you didn't have to experience when they were there, so which could be making it even more difficult.
Yeah, and it's one of them where I knew stuff was always going on behind the scenes with Daryl and Faraz and all that. I get that. That's the backdrop and the political side of every football club is always something going, but what I try to do is just concentrate on the football. Like literally, you know, at the end of the day, that's the only thing I can affect, is try and win games and try and put in performances that can win games. And we did that by probably really concentrating on the players that we were trying to bring in, and then obviously making sure that they were not just the right player but the right person, because that was a big part of the cultural change, making sure that we had the right people at the football club.
I mean, as I mentioned, the players you brought in, six of them now playing in the Championship week in, week out. That doesn't even include Callum O'Dowd, who obviously came through the youth system as well. You obviously had a great relationship with academies as well in the Premier League. You're looking at the likes of Joe Rothwell and Ryan Ledson coming in, John Lundstrom, all these players. Is that crucial to recruitment? I'm basically trying to get out, how did you go about creating such an amazing group of players at that level who just in a couple of years later are quite obviously too good for it?
Well, first and foremost, there had to be a remit. What was our remit? And our remit at the time was that we wouldn't just look in one pond, so to speak. So it wouldn't just be under 23 players from Premier League clubs. We made sure that there was a certain age bracket that we were looking at, and if we had to go and look in the lower leagues in the conference, then we would do. If we had to go up to Scotland, because obviously they weren't paying as well as maybe the Championship and some of the League One clubs at the time were paying.
You look at Marvin Johnson and Shea Dunkley being the two there.
Absolutely. And you know, and there's some that didn't particularly work out for one reason or another, in terms of, you know, the likes of, people will look at the Kane Emmings one and say it didn't work out, but he scored really crucial goals for us in the season that my last season that we left, and obviously he's moved on since, but you know, he was still part of a successful squad. But yeah, I mean, the remit in terms of the age group that we were looking at was spot on, and we tried to stick to it because we had certain experienced players that we know we could sort of keep and stay involved in the squad that could help the younger players come through. But not only that as well, is, you know, I spoke to Daryl often about this and just said to him, look, I understand where he's coming from. He wants return on investment. That's his background, you know, from what he did previously. He's an investment banker before he got involved. You don't be the CEO of LDC, Lloyd's Capital, for 13 years, and you know,
but in fairness, it's a good blueprint for success on the pitch. If you're turning over players and making money, then
I just kept saying to him, you know, you're gonna have to put your trust in me to, you know, put a little bit of outlay or ask the question with certain clubs whether we can take a player, and we might allow them to have a bit of a sell on. But initially, if we don't do that, we won't get the player in the first place anyway. And then just to trust me that, you know, ultimately over a year, 18 months, 2 years' time, not only would they help to keep us successful on the pitch, but obviously make money for the football club. And we made a hell of a lot of money for the football club. You know, it was a good relationship. It was a healthy relationship. And it was one that worked. You know, we knew it would work. We just needed someone to, and that was the thing I said to Dan. I said, I said, we won't get precious if we get one wrong.
Yeah.
You know, and that was important as well. I said, the reality is every three players assigned, I'm probably going to get one wrong. You know, I said, but I'm not going to get precious about it. I'm not going to be one of these people who keep playing someone just because I've brought them in, or worry about if I've got him wrong or not. Instead of, I think that's what a lot of people sort of get wrong. They stick with someone and keep sticking with them. And then in the back of their mind, actually, this isn't working for whatever reason. You know, they've come to this football club, it's not worked. I promise myself, or I'd like to think, fulfilled that as well, where I didn't stick with him. It's right, okay, if it's not happening, we'll move him on, we'll bring the next one
in. Yeah, absolutely. One player who didn't make money on, but I can only thank you. I can't have you sitting here and not thank you for bringing Chris Maguire into my life, because he will always be my favourite ever Oxford player. And it's kind of good to see him doing so well at Sunderland, but it's good to see fans giving him the love that he needs in order to be effective, because when he's great, he's absolutely unbelievable. Last word on Oxford now, before I'm going to ask you just quickly about the Chequer trades and what you think about the competition. We never normally talk about it, which may let you know what we think, but before we finish, and then just on your plans for the future. But a final word on Oxford. It's pretty rare that a manager leaves in the middle of the summer, as you did, you know, when recruitment was presumably up and running and you were planning on staying for the next season. Was it a case of just the job came up to work with a mate in the Premier League and you had to jump at it, or was there more where you could see that maybe things behind the scenes weren't necessarily the working environment you wanted to be in?
Probably a tad of both. More definitely so that the opportunity that come about with someone who are new, trusted and worked with before to work at that level, that was definitely the biggest factor. Like I say, my relationship with Darryl was very, very good, but I did know that, you know, there was interested parties in the club, so I didn't know 100%, you know, what the future held for the football club. And because of my experiences at Blackpool and previously at Portsmouth, that was something.
Alarm bells.
Yeah. It was at the forefront of my mind and I was aware of. So when the opportunity came about, it was one that I felt was the right time. And I generally think at that moment in time, it was the right time for both me and Oxford United. And it's one of them, you never say never, you know, at the end of the day, you know. And I said that to Darryl. I said, you know, whether it's him still involved at Oxford United or elsewhere, or me, you know, working again at Oxford United in the future, who knows? I don't know.
But you're going to set the forum wild with that one, I think.
But, you know, it's one of them where I've already had that question previously when Pep... you know, left last season, and I, you know, it was one of them where I'm sure I was waiting for the, you know, the absolute avalanche of are you going back? Yeah. And
was there contact with the club?
I mean, there was conversations with me and good friends I've got at the football club, are all members of staff there, you know, saying, like, you know, what's the chances? but listen, like I say, I don't know what's going to happen in the sort of near future, long term future or not, but one thing I do hope is that, you know, they start winning games again and winning games quickly, and I'd like to see him competing at the top end of the table rather than the bottom end of the table.
Yeah, I echo that. Hopefully starting on Saturday against Plymouth, Carl Robinson can turn this around. Onto the Chequer trade now, a competition that with Oxford, you reached the final twice. I'm not a fan. I think that EFL clubs are basically treated pretty badly in it with the rules about team selection. Yeah. And I'm, you know, concerned about the B team factor, although I think that looks unlikely now. As a manager, was it an important tool to use? Obviously it worked very well getting to the final, but were those early stages where we are now, were they more of an annoyance than an opportunity to play football matches?
Yeah, no. Interestingly, for me, no, they weren't. I actually quite enjoyed them, and the reason I enjoyed them, it gave me the opportunity to back up what I was saying to some of the players on the fringes. You know, I tried very, very, very hard to make sure that everyone felt as if they were part of, you know, what was going to be a big season in all the seasons that I had there. So to give them an opportunity to play some football was important for me, and not just to set up a friendly at the training ground against the local side to keep them match fit. It was an opportunity to keep them match fit. But then the reality is, and the players who were there will tell you, you know, the very first game we had, you know, I was very, very clear, lads, this is an opportunity to go and play at Wembley.
Yeah.
You know, forget anything else. you know, we're five or six games away and we're not playing a Premier League side. We're not playing a Championship side that should or expect to beat us. We're playing with sides in around us, whether it's in our own division or the one below or the one up, that we're more than capable of beating. So them conversations took place before the first game and during the first game, I can assure you, and continued all the way up until the final. Just for whatever reason.
You're the only team having those conversations.
Maybe, you know, but I think we were being positive and, you know, and I like to think that we had a squad that was more than capable of coping with the amount of games that we played anyway. As it happened, you know, we ended up playing a hell of a lot more than I probably expected, because, you know, you can never say that you plan to get to the fourth and fifth round of the FA Cup, etc.
Well, I think going forward now, it's something you can say in your interviews that you played the 61 and 62 games for a reason, because you were winning games. Yeah. I mean, what is the plan now? Is it getting back into a job as soon as possible? And what level are you looking at?
Yeah, I mean, definitely, you know, a lot of people have asked me over the last couple of months whether, you know, are you going to go back in as number one or number two? The reality is I don't know. I would prefer to go back in as a manager if possible. I feel that's what suits my personality and my abilities. You know, it's one of them where it was interesting when I first come out of the game, you know, a lot of people see me as a coach and someone being on the grass, which I'm more than happy to do, and I love being on the grass. But I think once you've gone into the management side of it, I actually quite enjoy being in the boardroom and dealing with managing above. And, you know, when I've had time out of the game, I've been involved in a couple of business opportunities as well. So I enjoy that side of it, testing yourself against, obviously, some of the hierarchy. Yeah. I want to go back in as a number one if possible. For me, it's not about the level, if I'm being honest. I would love the opportunity to manage again in the Championship, just to put a few goals to bed, to prove a few people wrong. But I'm not obsessed with that in the slightest little bit. For me, it's about the club. And I've said that actually to a few people, a few managers at LMA events over the last couple of months. I said, if there's one thing I've learned, and obviously, you know, I'm what, 42 now, 43 in December, I've got a hell of a lot of experience for someone of that age in terms of management. And I say to him, whatever you do, don't pick the level, pick the club, you know, because, you know, ultimately, if you want to be a Championship manager, there might be a club in League Two right now that's more than capable of doing that in two seasons, you know, and that's the important thing. So whatever's next for myself, who knows? But certainly, you know, I'd love the opportunity to get back into work sooner rather than later. You know, so yeah, I'm more than ready and fit and willing.
Well, if any potential employers are listening, as a fan, I can vouch for Michael's managerial skills. It was an unbelievable 3 years that you spent at Oxford United, and hopefully one day we'll see you back there again. But thank you so much for joining us here today, Michael. It's been a pleasure speaking to you.
Brilliant, much appreciated.
If you've just found out about the podcast because we've got Michael on, then make sure you do subscribe via SoundCloud or via iTunes, because we are producing two podcasts a week covering the EFL, and you can see us on Sky Sports on EFL Matters once a month as well. So lots going on, and we hope to have many more interviews with the people of the calibre of Michael going forward.